Here is the latest from K2 Radio News.
In today's episode, I was happy to talk to Dan Starks. He is the founder of the National Museum of Military Vehicles. It's one of the most premier military history museums in the United States. USA Today recognized it in 2020 as one of the top 10 new attractions in the United States. The focus of the museum is to tell the stories of how these vehicles were used and to remember the valor of service members who fought and sometimes died in them. The museum also houses a large, historically significant firearms collection. The first thing that I wanted to talk to Mr. Starks about is the Veterans Fair that they're putting on. More than 40 community partners will be providing things like chair yoga, virtual reality demos, animal therapy, and so much more.
Hi, Colby. This is Dan Starks at the National Museum of Military Vehicles. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing well. How are you this morning?
I'm doing well, too. Craig Blumenschein told me that he arranged for you and me to talk.
He sure did, yeah, and told me the Veterans Fair is coming up May 25th at the National Museum of Military Vehicles in Dubois, and it's free for anybody to attend, so I just had a few questions about it.
Wonderful.
Okay, well, first thing, is this the first year, or is this something you've done in the past?
This is the second annual. We did our kickoff program last year on Memorial Day weekend and as a pilot program. And now this year, based on last year's learnings, the program is significantly expanded and, including being supported by national recognition.
Why do you think it's important to host this fair?
Well, we can't do enough for our veterans, and the unmet needs of our veteran community are tremendous, but, across the country, but especially here in Wyoming, we have the highest veteran suicide rate per capita of any state in the union. And so it's kind of counterintuitive for us to realize that we have veterans that are so isolated and so much at risk. And so our goal is to make every day at the museum Veterans Day. And this is one of the ways we can make that meaningful, real, and not just words.
Is there going to be a theme this year?
Yes, the theme is Circles of Healing, Service, and Growth. And so we have more than 30 organizations from around the country spearheaded here locally with the Wyoming Veterans Commission and this award-winning Veteran Talking to Veterans program, a nonprofit organization that just was recognized by the VA at a national level as an outstanding program to benefit trauma-impacted veterans. So we have mental health services, support connection services, equine therapy, goat therapy, other animal encounters. We have health workshops. We have job fair resources available to people, and both on the how to start up a business, a small business administration, Veterans Business Outreach Center is going to be here offering information to veterans on business ownership. We've got the Red Cross is going to be here with a number of different programs and workshops, other veteran focused, the Sheridan VA is sending a group here to reach out to veterans in Wyoming. We have the Casper Veterans Center is going to be here in force. We've got the Wyoming Parks and actually is going to be providing opportunities, family fun kinds of things to help make this not just informative, but fun for the whole family and something that people can enjoy. We're going to do tank demonstrations during the afternoon. We're also going to offer free military vehicle truck rides for families and kids. And so, there's a full day of information and fun and reaching out to veterans and their families and letting them know that how much we appreciate what they've done on behalf of the country and that we're here for them to help them now that the military service is over.
Oh, that's amazing. Will there be any special guests or speakers?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. Oh, Governor Gordon is going to speak. We have General Henry Huntley from the United States Department of Veteran Affairs is coming in from D.C. We've got one of his colleagues, Conrad Washington, from the Center for Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships in the VA is going to be here. Another speaker will be the person in charge of the VA's Office of Rural Engagement. We have a speaker from the National Board for Health and Wellness Coaches, the CEO of the nonprofit organization that created and administers the Veterans Talking to Veterans program, Julie Ellidge, will be speaking. And so it's a good lineup of speakers. There's also going to be a graduation ceremony for newly certified credentialed coaches who implement the Veterans Talking to Veterans program, just all kinds of things.
Is this going to be happening inside the museum?
It'll be happening in the part of the museum where we've created a conference center. So we have a large room that accommodates 500 up to 599 people and is supported by a catering kitchen. We have breakout rooms for these different workshops in the museum. We also are putting up a 10,000 square foot tent, a large sided lit tent in the parking lot, it'll be more or less adjoining. Functionally, it'll be adjoining the indoor building so that people can go in between the building and this 10,000 square foot tent. So we're set to accommodate a large number of attendees in a very comfortable way for everyone.
And what about food? Is that being provided, or will there be food trucks or something on site for people to grab a bite to eat in between workshops?
Yes. We have food trucks, and then we also have our own restaurant and catering kitchen. So we're going to make sure that everybody's got lots of food opportunities while they're here.
And about the museum, is that also going to be open to the public that day?
Yeah, the museum will be open as normal. So the Veterans Fair is free. Admission to the museum will be as usual, which means veterans are always admitted free. Others pay a nominal fee to come in and view the exhibit galleries and all of the vehicles in the museum.
I believe that the museum boasts 500 restored military vehicles from different branches. Is that right?
Yeah, that's my collection. That's my personal collection, the largest private collection in the world. 500 vehicles. About 220 of them are physically embedded in the museum in different exhibits. And the exhibits include one of the most famous exhibits that we have isn't a vehicle at all. It's the musket that fired the very first shot at the Battle of Bunker Hill in 1775. Is a real gem of the whole collection. But we have vehicles from World War I, World War II, the Korean War, Vietnam War. On site, we have a number of post-Vietnam War vehicles as well. Those are waiting for construction of another building in order for us to have galleries about the Gulf Wars, the Global War on Terror, and other more recent conflicts.
How did you get started collecting all these things?
It started as a modest goal I acquired a junked Sherman tank. It was a 30-ton paperweight, gutted, just rusting out in a field. I was able to acquire that for $50,000 with a goal of finding someone to restore it to driving condition so that my wife and I could drive it in the Dubois 4th of July parade. So that's, I just wanted one vehicle that I could drive in the parade.
Oh, wow.
And from there, Things kind of went a little nuts, and now I've got 500 vehicles.
When was that the first one? What do you remember? What year it was?
Oh yeah, I bought it in 2010, and from 2010 to 2014, that was the only vehicle I had. But it was far more trouble than I realized to find someone to restore it to driving condition. And so in 2014, I bought my second tank already restored, and drove it in the Du Bois 4th of July parade that year in 2014. Since then, I've acquired 498 additional vehicles.
And where did these come from? How do you acquire them?
They come from all over the world. I purchased about half of them already located somewhere in the United States. The other half I purchased outside the United States and imported them here to be restored and otherwise mixed into my collection. So I've acquired vehicles from every country in Western Europe, from Australia, from Canada, from to a limited extent from South America, I've acquired vehicles from other collectors here in the United States, many of whom themselves imported those vehicles, although then I bought them already located here. I acquired vehicles from other museums that have shut down due to financial difficulties and liquidated their collections. I've acquired some vehicles by finding them on eBay, so you just never know.
And there's a firearm collection as well, right?
Yes. We have a high security weapons vault with weapons dating back to the French and Indian War, the Revolutionary War, a few Civil War weapons, but the focus is on World War One weapons, World War Two weapons, Korean War and Vietnam War, and then some more modern weapon systems. There must be there's at least 300 weapons in the weapons vault. Some of them are just really rare one-offs. We've got a Wyatt Earp revolver, for example. I have a General Patton pistol. I've got a Chief Rain in the Face model 1873 Winchester. Chief Rain in the Face fought in the Battle of the Little Bighorn and may very well have used this particular Winchester in that battle. We've got other demilitarized weapons in the weapons vault, a variety of rocket launchers, the Stinger surface-to-air missile, and, you know, just all kinds of things. We've got an example of the very first anti-tank rifle, and an example of the very last anti-tank rifle, and others in between. So there's some people spend a few hours in the weapons vault taking everything in.
And all these collections really tell a story about the past. For you, is that why it's meaningful?
Yeah. I tell people that that the museum is a bit of a misnomer. People think that they're going to come and see vehicles lined up next to each other like you might see in a car show, and that's not what the museum is at all. And the major mission of the museum is for us to honor the service and sacrifice of veterans and their families. The second major mission is for us to educate next generations on the history of American freedom and make sure that younger people are exposed to some of the key ingredients of American freedom that they don't learn about in schools anymore. So the vehicles really are kind of bait. Tongue in cheek, I say that we are running a bait and switch program, that people often come to see vehicles, but they stay to learn the stories about veteran service and sacrifice and sacrifice of veterans' families and about the history of American freedom.
And as far as that experience for a visitor, I've not been yet. I definitely need to go and bring my family. They would love that. You said they're not like lined up like a car show. How do you cater to that ambiance of respect and trying to honor the veterans?
Several ways. First, the museum creates an immersive experience. So nothing at all like vehicles lined up next to each other. We display the vehicles in context with staging around them and with reader rails and with lighting and supported by images. We have computer interactions. We have audio and projection animation. And so people will often comment that in different parts of the museum, they feel like they're right there. For example, in the Battle of the Bulge, we have a very immersive winter scenery as part of our storytelling. We, in our Korean War gallery, we have animation and sound and with showing snowfall in mountains with the 1st Marine Division fighting its way out of a trap at the Chosin Reservoir in December of 1950. We have a Vietnam jungle. People walk through to put themselves in the shoes of 19 and 20 year old Americans who served in combat in the jungle in Vietnam. We have a very immersive artillery fire base demonstrating additional components of the war in Vietnam. So the immersive displays are critical. And people have said a number of times, they said, you know, this isn't really a museum. A museum doesn't do justice to us. This is an entire experience that people have walking through the museum and finding themselves touched very emotionally as well as intellectually by the displays and experiences we provide in our galleries.
And I think you can still operate some of the vehicles.
Oh, yeah. With very limited exception, every American vehicle that is inside the museum is operable. We restored there are a couple of exceptions, but almost every vehicle we restore the driving condition. The only thing that doesn't operate in the vehicles is the firearms. So the cannon, the main guns and things have been demilitarized or are just props, but the vehicles themselves, including our Vietnam War helicopter and including our World War II Higgins boat and our Vietnam War Brown Water Navy patrol boat, all of them are operable. We had to take the fuel and oil and batteries out to bring these vehicles inside for fire marshal compliance reasons, but almost all of them have been restored to driving condition.
Are there aircrafts?
Yeah, we have. So I decided not to include aircraft in my collection when I began doing this, but I have. I couldn't help myself, and do have several aircraft. Of particular note, we have an example of a prototype experimental aircraft that Germany was still developing when World War II ended, and this is the first manned rocket in human history, is credited by NASA as providing the dawn of manned spaceflight.
Wow! Well, that's incredible. Do you take these vehicles around to other events?
We drive vehicles in the Du Bois 4th of July parade. Every July 4th. Last year, we drove 28 vehicles down the main street of Du Bois as part of the 4th of July parade. We had, for example, an M60 main battle tank, an M48 patent tank, World War II tanks, other armored vehicles, other soft skin vehicles. And so that's what we focus on. It's actually quite an endeavor. It takes a lot of support. It takes a lot of trucking. It takes a lot of service vehicles to respond to the inevitable breakdown of vehicles along the parade route. It takes a significant maintenance team, mechanics to support putting vehicles in the parade. So we don't take them around to other cities, to other towns, but we drive them in our parade every year. And then we also offer vehicle demonstrations as special events at the museum, including at the Veterans Fair, for people to see these vehicles in operation.
Do you have sponsors or partners for the museum and any events that you put on?
Yeah. So the museum itself does not have sponsors for the museum. The museum is funded, is privately funded by my wife and by me, but for events, like for the Veterans Fair, we have sponsors and co-sponsors. Of the Wyoming Veterans Commission is a sponsor of the Veterans Fair. the nonprofit organization called Mentor Agility that created this Veterans Talking to Veterans program is a sponsor of the Veterans of FAIR. So we're new enough. We really just did our grand opening Memorial Day weekend of 2022. So we're new enough that we're still developing our programs, but intend to fully collaborate with all interested and capable organizations as we develop more programs beyond our Veterans Fair.
Wow, so you haven't been open terribly long. How far do people travel to come see the museum?
People travel from all over the United States. So our starting point for annual attendance is 40,000 visitors a year. We were recently the focus of a Fox Nation Laura Ingraham series called Hidden Gems of America, and we were her first episode. That 30-minute program gave us a lot of national visibility, and a number of people have come from just all parts of the United States to Du Bois as a destination because they wanted to see the museum and because they found out about it either on the Hidden Gems of America program or on other word of mouth or other other sources.
And I think you guys started a YouTube channel, right?
Yeah, that's right. We just started it in December. Well, I think we officially had a YouTube channel, but it wasn't serious. We began to be very intentional about our YouTube program just this last December. And now we regularly post videos to share what is in the museum with people that either haven't come or can't come to the museum. And the YouTube initiative is off to a very good start. We're getting close to, in one case, over 200,000 views. And we're headed toward 200,000 views on another one of our videos. And we're getting feedback that our videos are very high quality, very credible, and well done. So the program's brand new and still building.
Is being educational part of your goal?
The educational is a huge part of our goal, and so we on several levels. One, we explicitly define education as a key part of our mission when we talk about educating next generations on the history of American freedom. But a big part of what we want to do on the veteran side, with honoring veteran service and sacrifice and that of their families, we want to educate those of us like me who have never served in the military. Such a small percent of Americans now have served in our veterans, only about 7%. And so most of us don't know much at all about military service and the experience of military families. And so we want to educate the vast majority of Americans who otherwise might be completely unconnected with the American military experience, so that we all are clear on the debt that we owe to that small percent of Americans who are carrying the burden for all the rest of us with their military service. And we want to educate all of us who haven't served on kind of the price that our veterans, particularly our combat veterans, pay. All of the traumatic experience, all of the disorientation that often is part of the veteran experience transitioning back into civilian life. So, education is mostly what we do.
And having been a collector so long, I wonder what your thoughts are on how wars and generations change. And have you been able to see an evolution, or are there things that are always the same?
It's a good question. And not so easy to answer. On the one hand, on a superficial level, the technology of warfare really changes fairly rapidly. And so we even just in our World War II gallery, for example, we show where different vehicles and weapon systems started, what the state of the art was at the beginning of World War II, and how rapidly it changed just in that few years that we participated in World War II. So the technology evolution is remarkable. The thing, though, that is non-changing, it's kind of like eternal truths. The human the impact on the human spirit and the, you know, the remarkableness of humans stepping up and putting their lives at risk and just taking so much injury, that no matter what the technology of warfare is, that human experience of it, and the human experience of families of military members going without members of the family who are deployed usually overseas for very extended period of time, that doesn't change. And the value of you know, another thing that doesn't change is the need to the realization. We have a quote in the museum in Latin from Roman times, a famous Roman quote about, if you want peace, prepare for war. And so that's a, you know, that's like a, and it seems like just a truth of the human condition. Those who want peace the most, you know, might appreciate that connection of, you've got to have a strong military, peace through strength. We won't have peace by disarming. We won't have peace by having a weak military. And the primary purpose of our military is to preserve peace, not to actually go to war. So that doesn't change. That dates right back to Roman times and before. And the value of the freedom that is created and preserved with appropriate military focus is another just truth of the human condition. We've got we track you know, really well, and we, you know, we, well, there's a lot of things, I'm rambling a little bit, I apologize, but we track how many years since the birth of the United States. We track it back to 1775, the Battle of Bunker Hill. How many years since the Battle of Bunker Hill have we not needed our military? And what we documented is we've used our military. We've needed our military to engage on our behalf every single year throughout the history of the United States, except for 2 years. 1 year was 1829, 1 year was 1897. And so that then tells, you know, that, and we show our work. We document it by year. We document it by what continent did the conflict take place on. We document it by how many Americans participated in that conflict and which branch of the military. And we show it all graphically on a long wall. And so there, you're, again, that you a takeaway from that is there's something about the human condition that requires the strength of a military to protect our way of life and to preserve our freedom, and that doesn't change. And so, you know, and another thing that doesn't change is if we recognize how important it is that we continue to have Americans being willing to step up and serve, and say, okay, well, man, we're not going to do very well if people quit being willing to step up and serve. Well, what do we have to do to make it more likely that Americans will step up and serve? We've got a quote from George Washington back in the late 1700s where he says, the willingness of young people to serve in future wars, no matter how justified, will be in direct proportion to how they perceive the nation has treated and appreciated its veterans. So again, that kind of having, and not just the quote, not just the thought, but the timing of it, that was hundreds of years ago, and it just hasn't changed since then. We've got to treat our veterans appropriately, not just as a matter of ethics and morality, but as a matter of self-interest of every one of us. If we quit treating our veterans appropriately, Americans are not going to be willing to continue to step up and serve, and we're all going to lose our freedom.
So I want to loop it back to the Veterans Fair one more time. I think it begins at 8 a.m., if I wrote that down correctly, 8 a.m.
Yes.
May 25th. And does it go all day?
Yes, it does. It goes until 6 o'clock.
Oh, okay. For people who've never been, you guys are in Dubois. Would you give a local description of how to get there?
We are about the same distance from Jackson as we are from Riverton and as we are from Lander. So those are the three gateways to come here, where the museum is right along Highway 26. We're at mile marker 64, about 7 miles east of Du Bois itself. We have a nice museum campus. People can't miss it. We've got a lot of vehicles outside. We've got flags from every branch of the military outside. So a very, very attractive, eye-catching presentation of the museum for anybody driving past it on Highway 26.
This has been Report to Wyoming, presented in the public interest by Town Square Media.